starting. But so just tell me a little bit about the UFC. Like, so if do you have a, and this has got actually nothing to do with the chat. This is, I just find this interesting. So if you're a UFC fighter, would there be levels, and the higher level you are, the less you pay to access those services that you guys offer?
Nah, so all the UFC roster, it's equal. You don't pay anything to access the services. So
really?
If you're a UFC fighter, yeah, if you've got a contract with the UFC, you're on the UFC roster, you can come to the PI in Vegas or Shanghai. It's free of charge. Physical therapy, sports dietetics, strength conditioning, sports science, all those things free of charge for the UFC fighters. And so the UFC actually does a good way in helping the fighters like that. And then, of course, also in Shanghai, we've got technical coaches as well. So some UFC fighters have come out and spent time with us picking up things from our technical coaches. They might have spent like 6 weeks or something like that with Maxim, as long as the UFC fighter, rostered fighter, stayed there. It's not a Chinese. This was an American girl. She came out and stayed with us for like 6 weeks just to learn new techniques and things like that from our technical coaches at the PI in Shanghai.
That's amazing, isn't it? It's so different to almost anything else that's out there, like in terms of the setup, the structure, the looking after your athletes, it sounds like it's really well done.
Yeah, look, there's some people, Lawrence Epstein he's the CEO of UFC, and he was probably one of the catalysts for the UFC PI being created. And there's this, and then there's Duncan French, who's basically my boss. He's the VP of performance, and this whole model of servicing the athletes. And it's not to be pragmatic, but it also helps the UFC as well. For instance, fighters that make weight, then there's less bouts cancelled. The more fighters that aren't injured, the bouts are better. Yeah. So look, it's a win-win situation.
If you compare that, you know, and in terms of injuries and head knocks and stuff like that, compare that to like the NFL, who for years we know they hid the concussion rates and the consequences of that. And you look at a lot of other sports, like even tennis, like athlete welfare is not considered in the slightest by the ATP or the WTA. It's all about what brings in the bucks. So the UFC are kind of saying, hey, we know what's bringing in the bucks, but let's look after these people as best we can. Because yeah, it does benefit our back pocket, but we're investing in it. There are not many sports that are doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think to the same level. Like, I'm sure ATP or World Surf League, you know what I mean? They'll provide physios and chiropractors for the actual events that guys could use if they want, but it's not like a full-time, full, any time you want, you can come here and we'll look after you. And if you want to stay here full-time, like, there's fighters that have moved to UFC rostered fighters that have moved to Las Vegas just to be part of the PI and access to all the services there. We've had the same thing in China with Chinese rostered fighters, not guys in the academy, which is the level below the UFC roster, but guys that are rostered. They basically moved to Shanghai so they can train out of the facility full time.
Because, you know, Adidas tried that from a tennis perspective. So they got Darren Cahill, who coached Leighton, he coached Andre Agassi, and they got Andre's strength and conditioning coach, Gil Reyes. So that we spent some time in Vegas when I was with Ash Barty, and that was what they were trying to set up. But I think at the end of the day, and Adidas athletes could tap in, tap out, whatever. But at the end of the day, I just think Adidas candidate, cost-wise, it just wasn't worth it. But so hopefully that doesn't happen in your case.
Yeah. Hey, fingers crossed.
All right, Joseph Coyne. Guys, please welcome Joe onto this. If I can ask it, everyone, and it looks like everyone's done that, put their mics on mute. There is the chat option at the bottom of the screen, so please feel free to use that. Again, if you message everyone, I'll mention your name in that, and then Joseph can address you directly. However, if you're a bit shy or a bit embarrassed to ask the question, feel free to message me privately. I won't mention your name, and we can just ask the question and do that throughout the next hour or so as we're chatting. Please remember, if you're interested in high school strength and conditioning, we've got Harrison Westbrook's had a chat. I've just mentioned Ash Barty, her strength and conditioning coach, as she is at world number one, Mark Taylor. We've had a chat with him, and very recently we've chatted with Charlie Higgins, which the feedback on that talk, his openness and his honesty, has been awesome. So Appreciate that. If you guys wouldn't mind, just a little shout out on social media would be really appreciated, a screenshot or something like that, or maybe even a takeaway message from the great man himself, Joseph Coyne. That would be really appreciated. Joe, welcome to the chat. Thanks very much for coming on. How are you going?
Yeah, good, man. Good. Thanks for having me on. It's been awesome what you've been doing, and some of the people you've got on so far. I feel humbled by their presence, basically.
I was trying to go back to when you and I first connected, because I was thinking it was about, I was presenting at the conference on tennis, and of the 3 days, there was one presentation I wanted to watch, and that was you. And you, I think you were doing surfing, and as it turned out, we were scheduled to do the same time. And I think that's the first time you're on my radar. And then I think maybe the year after we played some touch together. Is that something where we first connected?
Sounds pretty accurate. I did like basically how I looked after some of the guys on the WQS World Qualifying Series and surfing, mm-hmm. And some sort of gymnastics variations that I was using at the time for pulling and so on and that conference. And yeah, and then maybe I sidestepped you on the beach down at
surfers.
See, you're going one way and went the other way.
But you did have a background in football, didn't you?
I played union and league. I came to Australia and played league.
And what level? That was like Q Cup in the rugby league, sort of semi-professional, was it?
Mainly, so just grade below Q Cup. So they had a Fogs Cup in Queensland for a while. And I played for Seagulls.
Okay.
Which was Tweed Seagulls, the old Gold Coast Seagulls club.
Yeah. And just a bit, because you're a qualified teacher, is that right? Is that what you studied?
Yeah. Man, the story behind that is when I went to university, right, I'm old enough that there wasn't any sports science degrees. There was only really one place in New Zealand that had like a sporty degree, and that was physical education. But it was 4 years and it didn't give you any teaching qualifications. So then after that, if you want to be a teacher, and New Zealand government said, hey, we're short male teachers, we're going to give every male 15 grand to go and do a teaching diploma if you wanted to. So I took advantage of that. And so I did an extra year after my PE degree, which didn't let me teach PE. So
okay. And then so from there, you use that as a stepping stone to you always wanted to be strength and conditioning. Is that right?
Yeah, man. To be honest, I didn't know what I wanted to be. Like when I went to university, I was like, I'm into sports. What am I going to do? I thought about law. Like probably if I had my time again, maybe I'd do something like medicine. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew I was into sports. And so I did this physical education degree. And like part of that, when I said that graduate diploma, I went and did that. And I was like, one of the placements, actually. I went out to this place in Central Otago, and there was a guy who was nearing retirement, and he basically just spent his day teaching high jump, coaching some athletics, and he was a golf pro as well. So he'd take the kids down and have hits of golf. I was like, this is pretty good. This is what I want to do. And so that was the sort of teaching thing. And then when I went to... I'd always been into S&C, for my undergrad, we did some stuff with New Zealand Academy of Sport, as it was called then, and I was so interested in all those type papers and topics and the athletic training, so that was always a massive motivational factor. And then, yeah, I came to the Gold Coast and played like a year pretty much without working, played rugby league and was lucky enough to sort of get by, and then I started doing some training, but I did always want to work at elite sport, but it was kind of like a roundabout way of going teaching and going, yeah, I actually really like this as well, and this type teaching facet and helping people learn is pretty cool as well.
Okay, and then if we fast forward to, I think I came down to visit you somewhere around 2014-15. You had a pretty schmick facility down on the Gold Coast. I remember noticing straight away filled with Eleco plates. So how did you get from on the Gold Coast playing footy to this pretty cool facility?
Yeah, so what happened there? It must have been earlier than 2014-15. Must have been like 2012.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, it would have been because a young tennis player, I think she's maybe just cracked in the top 100 right at the moment. Kimberly Birrell was training with you, and I was with Tennis Australia. And yeah, so yeah, you're right. Maybe 2012, somewhere around there.
Man, she's awesome. She's awesome. Lovely girl. So stoked for Kim.
Yeah.
And the family, John and Roz. Yeah.
Yeah.
Super. I saw she made like the past the qualifiers for Australian Open maybe last year.
Yep. Yeah. A couple months ago. Yep.
Sensational.
Yeah. So tell me a bit about this facility. How did you go from a footy player to having that facility?
Well, yeah, I signed up as a personal trainer at Fitness First.
Yep.
Like most aspiring S&C coaches do. And then, so I ended up working there. While I was working there, I got into sort of the professional development. One guy was Charles Poliquin, DeFranco, all that type of stuff. And I went over to the States a fair few times and saw these like private strength and conditioning facilities. And I was basically like, I want one of those.
Yep.
I want to do that on the Gold Coast. I'm going to do that on the Gold Coast. And in that meantime, me going back and forth to the States a fair few times, so these courses and seeing these facilities, I'd got involved with ESA, which is what they're called now. They used to be called ACE. And got my sort of exercise physiology ticket based on my degrees and whatever. And then I'd been doing some work out of the gym. I was still working at Fitness First and then also working out of a chiropractor's one day a week, helping like treat patients and whatnot. And then I managed to scrounge enough money and get enough credit card debt together to start my own place.
Okay.
Modeled on these places I'd seen in the US.
Yeah, because I think it had the Prowler track, it had the lifting platforms, it had the, and I think upstairs there was some massage or rehab or something like that happening too. They mentioned one person's name, they're Charles Poliquin. And I know you've done a lot of his things. And I remember reading a tweet or something on social media where you, I think, were pretty bummed when he passed away, and rest in peace, Charles Poliquin. But for me, you're the one exception that I've had where I've normally stayed away from his certificates or his people who've gone through his courses, because I found that he almost had like disciples. Coming up, you know, once they qualified, it was like kind of Charles Poliquin's way and the wrong way. Is that something you've noticed, or have I just had a really weird...
For sure. Very dogmatic, similar to sort of Paul Check and maybe some of the courses. And also I've done some Paul Check courses and they're awesome as well.
Yeah.
But it's like anything, like there's some good things that you can take from stuff, and there's some attitudes that you can avoid, or prevalent attitudes. So... I got heaps of value out of them. I met some great people. And like even I got to know Charles a little bit, like he had barbecues at my place, that sort of thing. And like part of that was definitely a business strategy for him.
Because you sold some of his supplements at one stage, didn't you?
Yeah, you bet.
Yeah.
You bet. Hey, stock his supplements in the facility.
Yeah, because I've wondered, because of the experience I've had with you and your sort of open-mindedness there, I actually wondered if you did a Charles Poliquin course, maybe if you're a little bit more mature, you kind of pick and choose the good and the not so good, or maybe the attitudes behind it. But when I was a younger coach, they kind of really bought into that more disciple thinking, which is really how I'd never want any of my interns to be. So I wonder if that had something to do with it. Did you, because you kind of would have been a little bit older when you interacted with him.
For sure, man. For sure. And like I can think of other guys that work in pro sport. Like I'm thinking of like the Tampa Bay NHL, Tampa Bay Lightning NHL strength coach right now. Like he did some courses with me. You know what I mean? Guy'd done a like research degree, all that sort of stuff. And so he knew what was going on and took the real good points out of it and took what he needed and applied it to his practice.
Yeah. All right. And then, okay, so you've got this facility, and this is what, when I was reaching out to you, I thought it was really fascinating, because my goal was always to prepare an athlete for the pinnacle of their sport. As it turned out, it was Wimbledon. And then I was going to go move into the private sector, but you've done exactly the opposite. You went private sector and then employed. Tell me a little bit about that.
Man, you know what? I had like a light bulb. I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm not going to go and do my master's degree or my PhD or whatever straight after I finished my undergrad, because I was sick of university. I'd done 5 years And I basically, like I said, I was 5 years and I'd only just been able to teach a PE class after 5 years. So I need to get out of there. And but then I was like, I'm going to set up a business so that when I'm actually at university, I'm a master's student, I'm going to be earning some money, reasonable money while I'm doing it part-time. Mm-hmm. So that was, or PhD, whatever. So that was my thinking around it. And it was sort of, entrepreneurial, I guess, but I was like, I don't want to be the typical student that's, by the time I'm sort of 28, haven't earned any money. I need to start earning some money and getting stuck into some practice as well, in terms of like dealing with people and coaching people and personal training, whatever.
Now, I've got something to admit, and hopefully it's just the 14 people listening here, but when I was employed, I had this mindset that's where the best strength and conditioning coaches were. And I remember when I came to visit you and I saw your facility, and then I looked at, you were working with some elite athletes. I think in surfing, there was triathlon or Ironman or something like that. And it's been an interesting mindset shift for me, because at the time I thought, well, if he was good enough, Triathlon Australia would employ him or whatever it is. This is just me being honest. Like that's what I literally thought. But now I think, wow, like you had some of the best athletes in Australia paying out of their own pocket to work with you. And that's a different mindset.
So you've got to be good, right? If you can get free service through a national governing body as an athlete, or you're going to go and spend $60 a session to go and train with some guy out of a like private strength and conditioning facility where you need, you can't even find it with GPS. You better be doing a good job. So that was definitely, man, definitely. And how sport works, it's definitely a game of like who you know and where you've done your time and who you've been around. And I know heaps of great S&C coaches that might not necessarily be in the non-user pay setting, either e.g. in the institutes, or they're out like yourself in a private facility and doing a great job out of a private facility.
So, all right. So you, in that private sector, it feels like, and this is coming from someone who actually doesn't want to be employed, but it feels like you do get better recognition when you've got a logo on your shirt. So, whether it's the Broncos or the Reds or something like that. How did you find transitioning from having your own facility, running a business, still developing as a coach, and then moving into them, like trying to get into the employed sector, where I think, because you were with China in the track and field department or something like that, is that right?
Yeah, so what happened in 2014, Exos, who's like used to be, yes, called Athletes Performance at the time, maybe they just changed the Exos. We'd been talking for a while about me coming and doing some work for them. I ended up actually in a roundabout way, the first job that they offered me was a contract with Chinese Track and Field, just because I'd trained some sprinters, I'd done a little bit of track myself, to help me be fast for footy, not that I was exceptionally fast enough myself. And so that was the first thing that came across the radar, and they kind of offered to me. That didn't come through, but then another position came up as performance manager for the Exos team in China. And this was dealing at like their version of the AIS. So it's called the National Sports Training Center. It's in sort of South Second Ring, Beijing. It's where their most important sports train. So you've got the ones that win all the gold medals. It's like a gold medal factory. It's crazy. But weightlifting, gymnastics, badminton, ping pong, swimming is there some of the time. You've got volleyball, basketball facilities. You've got track and field there. And anyway, so I went there, and then after about 18 months, Exos actually lost the contract with the COC, mm-hmm, the Chinese Olympic Committee, and then I got picked up by Chinese Track and Field, and mainly due to Randy Huntington, who's a coach there, he wanted to have an assistant basically, and I came on as a physical preparation coach and also helped them out with some assistant coaching as well. Okay. And dealt not just with his group, but then across all their sprint and jump section, and they've got four different sections: one sprint and jump, one's distance, one's throws, and one's race walking. So I didn't want to do any time with race walking.
Wait, race walking got its whole category was what, race walking? of the four.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hey, they win a lot of gold medals in race walking. All right. So it's important. It's for China does anyway. So you know what I mean? It's an important facet of Chinese track and field is race walking.
Sure. I thought of, okay. So, you know, it was interesting. A while ago, I watched an interview with Louis C.K., the comedian. And he was explaining, like, one of the things that he does to try and make himself a better comedian is, apparently as a comedian, you're meant to put your best stuff at the end of your show. And what he would do is, once he realized what the best stuff was, he'd bring it to the beginning of the show and then force himself to be better than that and then bring that to the beginning of the show. So it's basically removing your strengths. And so at Propel, one of the things I did I did a 6-week period where I would sit in the middle of the gym, because I think one of my strengths is energy and moving around and connecting with athletes. So I took that strength away from me and I sat in the middle of the gym and tried to, you know, work on cueing and a whole bunch of other things where I couldn't move around.
Like cross-legged on the ground?
Not quite, on the GHR. So I'd sit in the GHR where I had a good view of this of our gym, and I'd try and not move, and I'd try correct and coach and motivate from a static position.
I can just see you sitting in the lotus position.
Sometimes I levitate, but no. So you've kind of done that in a way, but you've removed your whole language out of the situation. Is that true? What are these Chinese athletes that you're working with? I'm guessing English they're not fluent.
No. Actually, and it brings up a really good point. If I could say something about the education of a strength coach and what you want to do, you want to go and coach in an environment where English isn't the number one language and the athletes don't speak English for at least some portion of your time.
Yeah.
Because you will learn what is efficient and effective communication during that time. You'll also learn about different cultures and different beliefs. And just because, for instance, sports science tells us one thing, whether that is actually going to help a person whose belief structure might be totally against that particular intervention. So, man, it's a frustrating experience, but it's totally worthwhile. From my point of view, these guys, not many of them could speak English, and it also forced me to learn the language as well. And I speak Mandarin. I can coach in Mandarin.
Okay.
I wouldn't be a translator, but I wouldn't say I'm 100% fluent. I still harbour ambitions to become really, really fluent in Mandarin, but definitely it made me up my game in terms of how I presented material to athletes and what I said.
Give us some examples or situations where you feel it's made you a better coach, where you thought, oh, wait a second, I can't say that, or you become more efficient.
So normally when you first start, so what happened for my first role there, you'd have a translator with you most of the time. So this would be a person that a sports science graduate or master's student that had finished, and they'd be able to, they were pretty proficient in English, and they'd translate what you were saying to the athletes. But their proficiency in English wasn't at the same level as somebody that's grown up speaking English the whole time. So some of the things you'd say would get immersed and so on. And you quickly figured out that the best way of going about things was to involve them, set them up with what you wanted to do prior to the session. And then there's a whole heap of physical demonstration, getting key points across. This is exactly what I want to concentrate on. You know what I mean? And you couldn't spend too much time talking. If you were one of those coaches that is chest up, shoulders back, you know what I mean, throughout a set. By the time it actually gets through to the translator, then the translator tells the athlete, man, the set's over. It's and it's just constant verbiage. And the athlete's is whew, they've turned off. So they turn off when it's an English-speaking athlete as well, but now it's even double because all they're hearing is just background noise when they're trying to lift a big load in a barbell, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
wow. And so do you feel that, you now are back coaching in Shanghai with some athletes that do speak English. Do you feel that there's a knock-on effect, old Joseph might have said this, but new Joseph doesn't, or... can you feel a difference there?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. There's it's like anything. You just get better at your craft as you go along. And you, I learned a number of things, not just from the language barrier, but also in that position in China with all these gold medal sports, there are a lot of expat coaches over there that have been hired by China to come in and coach the national teams. And these coaches might be world record holders. They might have coached, like been to four Olympics as a head coach. And so you picked up all these little things, like it's like a melting pot that you'd see, like the basketball coach, Tom Mayer, for instance, he's a basketball coach, women's basketball coach, coached Australia for a number of years. His assistant was Michelle Timms. But after Australia, he went and coached New Zealand. New Zealand was something like 64th in the world, and he took him to the quarterfinals at the Olympics. So he's a great coach, man.
Yep.
Then he went to Great Britain. Oh, no, then he went to China. Then he went to Great Britain for another Olympic cycle. Then he went back to China. So the dude's been going to Olympics since probably before I was born.
Yep.
And so things he'll do, little, like, I don't want to say psychological tricks or manipulations, but some of the things he'll do, and you could tell he was doing it purposely, that you just pick up on that stuff and it refines you as a coach.
That's awesome. Now, one thing that I'm really keen to chat to you about is most of my history has been in team sports, even skill dominant sports. And I feel like if you gave me an athlete, if you gave me a tennis player, I reckon I could make them faster. If you gave me a football player, I reckon I could make them faster. But I would be really stressed if you said, mate, here's a guy who's ninth in the world for 100 meter sprints, make him faster. My depth of knowledge, I don't think would go that far. Tell me about you working with these sprinters who, I mean, some of them were what, top 20, top 15?
So, sprint and long. I work across sprint and jump. There were two male sprinters that broke 10 seconds in my time there. One guy went from 10:24 to like 9:98, I want to say. He'd run a couple of like...
Which is getting someone from, I don't know, 14 seconds to 12 is a totally different process to get them from 12 to 11. But what you're talking about there, like, that is a whole new level, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So
now, he didn't really have a coach either. So I spent a lot of time with him in terms of a technical coach. He was part of the men's 4x100, and the men's 4x100 coach actually coached his main rival, personal coach of the main rival, Subin Ten, who was the other guy below 10 that I also helped out a bit as well. But a lot of his progress, it was, surprised me too. You know what I mean? He was, he made a lot of progress just as maybe his development, maybe we're doing the right things in the gym. I heard some really high level coaches tell me when he was running 10:24, he's like, he won't run any faster than that. He's a 200 guy. He won't get down in 10:10s. And then, hey, a year and a half later, he's under 10. So, man, exceptional. And then long jump was probably the team I did the most with. And there were five guys in the top 20 during my time there. A couple of world championship medalists and things like that. So
pick one. I don't care. Jumping or sprinting. Tell us the process. I mean, as I said, like young athletes, to make them faster, you probably just get them to sprint a bit. That would be good enough. Tell us your process of how do you break down where you think you can add?
So first of all, you have to have a technical model. You have to understand the sport and understand what the coach was doing. I was really lucky. Randy Huntington, who was the coach for the long jump team when I was there, took me under his wing and got me right involved with like the overall programs and what he was doing. And I'd take the duels for the guys and that sort of thing and correct them on technique, just so I had a greater understanding of the overall program and how it fit in. And then it's like, you've got to be targeted. You've got to be saying, what's the window of opportunity? How do we find out that window of opportunity? And then what are we going to actually do to improve that? And then once we've improved it, has that actually made a difference? And then if it hasn't, you go back to the drawing board and try and find something else. But that's the thinking. And then that's a combination of looking at science, understanding what other coaches are doing, technology. For instance, we would have been one of the first people in the world using the 1080 sprint, which is becoming more and more commonplace. But all these type of interventions you can try and see how they go. But yeah, it's first of all, assess what the window of opportunity is and then make sure you know what wins at the sport. So for instance, long jump, I'll give you an example. This is how it might filter down. So long jump, and your last step on the board might be between 120 to 130 milliseconds. Mm-hmm. So 0.13 of a second. One of the guys is a Olympian, and he almost won the Diamond League series in 2016. He was like fast, but he was a bit of a scud missile, so he wouldn't get much arc to his long jump, wouldn't hold time in the air, still jump over 8 meters. And so then you're going, what's happening? Why is this happening? How are we going to make this better? Because in the gym, he's phenomenal. Like, the guy floats. Gravity doesn't work the same on him as it does the rest of us. It's stupid. So things I did, slow-mo video camera using something like the My Jump app, collecting data on what his last step is, the time on the board. And his time on the board was around 100 milliseconds to 110 milliseconds on average, meaning he wasn't staying there long enough
to produce the fall.
Yeah, to actually get the arc to the flight path.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it's changing.
Okay, so what was his ranking then when he's hitting at 100 mils? Roughly, what was he ranked in the world?
Well, at that time, he would have been like in the top 10.
Okay.
So, maybe top 5, because he was leading the Diamond League.
So at a top 10 level, he's an outlier already. How did you guys decide, wait a second, that's the cause of an issue, not maybe the cause of his success?
Yeah, so long jump is an interesting one, because, say, the coach, Randy Huntington, he coached Mike Powell. Mike Powell jumped 894.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, the sort of when Gao was sort of winning Diamond Leagues, he was jumping 810 to 820, maybe 825. And so there's been like this historical decline in long jump. And you've got a guy who's been there and got the world record, still has the world record as a coach, and he knows what produces jumps above 850. And then there's literature on it as well. Like there's technical reports from world championships and things like that. And so you can delve into these things. And so that was. Hey, we know how to make you better, even though you're one of the best in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, you're not as good as what some of the other guys could be.
Gotcha. Okay, so you look at that and you work out that this is the issue. Where do you even start coaching that to say, hey, slow down by 0.02, whatever it is?
Crazy, eh? So, crazy. 0.001.
0.001. So how do you coach that? What are some of the things that you're putting in place?
One, it's like video feedback. This is what's happening. This is the time duration. Then it's also, we tried changing around his, like some of his jumps in the gym. So instead of being really what I call poppy jumps or shocky jumps, he was having a bit more feel to it. So feeling the floor a bit longer in the jumps, getting a feel for that, especially on the depth jumps. Like your single leg depth jump will be probably the closest thing you'll get in a gym to that last step on the board. So that was a big consideration around that, just trying to get him to feel the actual ground a bit more from both a technical point of view and also a physiological type. What are we aiming to get out of these exercises?
Awesome. Now, Joe, having worked with a top 10 sprinter or two under 10-second sprinters, what do you reckon you could tell us about, say, getting a schoolboy faster, or if you had to bring it back, what are some of the things that we should be doing for young athletes or amateur athletes or semi-pro athletes?
Man, that's a tough one. And I can say this from experience. I almost say I'm better suited to working at the pointy end than with some kid trying to get faster. But just because my thinking's been like that for like the last 5 whatever years. But after I came back from Chinese at the track and field, it was 2017 World Champs, I came back to the Gold Coast and I spent about a year and a half, and I did sort of 3 days working as a director of athletics for a local high school on the Tweed Coast. And I was coaching kids athletics, and man, wow, it's like, basically I come down to really simple warm-up, teach a technical model with some type of storytelling cue, make sure the technical model is reasonably good, get them to run fast, and then give them feedback on how to maintain that technical model as they get better and better and better in the running.
Which is, I'm guessing, wouldn't have really changed much from before you had that experience and changed your mindset. I'm guessing that's a fairly basic way of coaching a sort of a non-elite sprinter.
Yeah, definitely. But
it'd be too much to feed back and say, hey, I'm going to change the way I do this.
Well, it was much more refined, I'd say. So even working at a basic level would be much more refined. Or with an introductory level athlete would be much more refined. And also just the concept that things take time. Yeah. There's only so much you can do in any one session. So if people can't get it, just keep your mouth shut, let them keep doing the reps. They'll figure it out maybe in the next session or the session after. But of course, hey, I totally respect high school coaches and dealing at that level, because it's not an easy one. Some kids are gifted, some kids aren't, and trying to get the point across to everyone in a group setting of 13 to 16 year olds can be quite challenging at times. Definitely.
Yeah, no, 100%. All right, we've got a question here from Justin. Joe, what's your take on the debate surrounding strength training with sprinters, i.e. lifting heavy, slow resistance, does or doesn't make you slower? So I suppose what Justin's asking is, well, what's your philosophy with strength training to make these guys faster?
So up to a certain point, it'll help. Maybe it's sprinting and jumping probably don't need as much strength as like a rugby league or a combat sport. So maybe it's like 1.8 times body weight in a back squat, something like that, just a general rule of thumb. Mm-hmm. But there will be instances where strength training will make a person slower, mm-hmm. where maybe you're taking away from time on the track. Maybe you're changing motor recruitment or changing a feel in the ground, just like, say, this long jumper I had. So there's definitely instances where if you do the wrong type of strength training, and I'll give you a thing that I used to do before going into competition. I didn't like the bar being on any of the sprinters' backs too much with heavy load. Because every time you have a bar on your back, you have disc compression, right?
Compression, yep.
Axial load. Now, sprinting is all about coordination and signals from your brain going out to the limbs to make them coordinated as fast as possible. If the outlets of those nerves are from the discs and now they're compressed, hey, maybe it's going to be impacting those electrical signals going out. So doing heavy work, it can be appropriate, especially early in the season for certain individuals. And then also some track and field athletes do better with it. Some do worse. So when you get to that level, it's about finding what type of athlete you have, whether they're going to respond to something heavy. Like some guys will do better having something heavy the day before competition. Some guys will do better not having anything heavy for the last 8 weeks before competition.
Yep.
And there's actually an example of a French sprinter who was like low tens. And basically they did some profiling him over in France. And he come up showing that he was pretty weak. He hadn't done much weights. And so they said, oh, we're gonna get you really good. This is a recent example. And basically never ran that fast again. So at the high level, definitely. Yep. Strength training can make you slower. But at the same time, it can also benefit you as well.
Yeah.
So it's about finding what works for that person.
So if we had to bring it back to that school setting and just looking at who we've got on the call at the moment, what would be some of the profiling or the almost like the flow charts of, hey, this person, I'm going to try to get them a little bit stronger. And this person, I think they've hit the threshold. They're strong enough. I'm going to try to get them, you know, more time on track.
Yeah, for sure. So at a school setting, it's like, can they do those functional fundamental movement patterns? That, like, can they squat, push, pull, twist, runge, Calvin Giles,
back crew, 5 and 5 or whatever?
Yeah, whatever. Those are the things. Can they do that? And then when they can do that, can they add load to it? Keep adding load to it. Once you get up around that sort of 1.8, 2 times body weight in a squat, you probably...
For what range?
For full range squat.
Full range squat, yep.
Or like 1.5 times body weight for a clean, something like that. You're probably not going to get that in a high school unless they're a gifted individual. It's mm-hmm. probably going to, at least in my experience, maybe now with kids training earlier, who knows. But when they get up around that, then you can say, oh, right, we don't need to concentrate on strength as much. And I'd say that for any level of athlete. Okay. And depending on the sport too, obviously something like rugby union, if you're like in the forwards, you might need greater levels of maximum strength than if you're a 100-meter sprinter. So
yep, sure.
All those things need to take into consideration.
All right, so you're working with this track and field team. You come back to the Gold Coast for about 18 months, I think it was. And then you get how did you land up in Shanghai now at the Performance Institute for the UFC?
Yeah, man. Well, so what was I saying before? It's like a lot of sports about who you know. So I was lucky enough to know Duncan French. He's the VP of performance there. I met him when I went across to the UK in 2013. And then we kept in touch. I ended up straight after, or pretty soon after I finished with China, I actually went out to Vegas to have a look at the facility there and hung out with Duncan. Then part of my PhD, I used Omega Wave. For people that aren't familiar with Omega Wave, it's like a measurement device that collects heart rate variability and also direct current potential. So it's very Russian. It's like you wear a belt, an ECG belt, and you put an electrode on your forehead and an electrode on your thumb, and you strap it on and you lie down in the morning, and it tells you whether you're good to train or not, basically. So the UFC uses that with a lot of their fighters. And then I also used it with the track and field guys before, during, and after Rio Olympics, up to 2017 world champs. So I'd used it, but part of my PhD was like getting some reliability statistics around it, getting some relationships with training load around that measurement device. And so I went out to the UFC for like 3 weeks, to collect some data for them. During that time, we started talking about this project they had in China. And then that was, look, it was probably like 18 months basically before it actually came off and I actually went to China. But that was the sort of genesis of it. And there was a recruitment process and it lasted a while. And you go out and you do some presentations to the powers that be and so on. And then I was lucky enough to get the nod for the role.
Okay. And so Duncan sits on top, and then does he have your position in Las Vegas, or is he also your position in Las Vegas?
He's basically me in Las Vegas. I'm him in Shanghai, just taller, better looking with more hair. Something like that. But he's also my boss. But yeah, I'm the equivalent to Duncan French in Shanghai.
And then you've taken a mutual friend with you, Gavin, is that right?
Yeah. And so I've known Gavin from ages ago. He worked for me on the Gold Coast, and now he's our strength and conditioning manager there. So he does all the strength and conditioning there. He's also got another strength and conditioning coordinator that helps him out. And then we've also got strength and conditioning interns that come in from the local university, and they help us train and do all the strength work with the athletes.
Okay. Now, when you get this job with the UFC stuff, I'm guessing you said it was a long, protracted program, interview process, and you've been working with them. So you obviously understood something about the sport before you started there. Was there anything that you, or any paradigms that you thought might be relevant, and then after working there for a while, kind of realized maybe they weren't?
I was pretty blank slate with it. And I had an understanding. I trained some sort of combat sport athletes back on the Gold Coast and had like jiu-jitsu players, and also treated some MMA guys and even some UFC fighters. And so I had a basic understanding. I wouldn't say there was anything that I changed, because mainly my thought process is around setting up weights and adapting to the circumstance, how to make training complementary across technical and non-technical aspects, and setting things up so that you're having as little amount of interference from each training modality you're using. Mm-hmm. But definitely things like weight cutting and how you incorporate that into a taper was something that I hadn't been, something that I've learned and I've really adjusted how I've thought for this particular instance around weight cutting. Just for the fact that the last week you pretty much can't do anything with the UFC, and how it works for people that aren't familiar with it, and just give you an understanding of the magnitude. say you're going to fight at 77 kgs, mm-hmm. all right? You might walk around day to day at 90 to 95 kgs.
Okay.
And the last week, it's a good thing if you are 10% by the Monday for the weigh-in Friday morning, it's a good thing if you're 10% over. So if you're about 85 kgs, that's awesome. You're on track to make weight in the last week.
Okay, so just so I understand, because I know powerlifting, each federation does this differently, and rowing with the lightweight stuff, a lot of it depends on when the weigh-in is, isn't it? Like if you weigh in 24 hours before or 2 hours before, this is going to affect it. So what happens in the UFC, just for some context?
So So you weigh in Friday morning, you fight Saturday night.
Okay, so you've got 36 hours?
Yeah. So it means you can have a really big weight cut. So if you're, say, 77, you're fighting 77, and you're 84 kgs on the Monday, that's awesome. You're on track. Mm-hmm. And then you go and do your, you have like low fiber, low carb diet, whatever. You sweat out a lot of weight on the Thursday evening, Friday morning, go and make weight. And you might rebound 15%. Some people 10 to 15%. Some people might rebound 18%. So by the time you get back into the ring and you're fighting, you might be back to 87 kgs fighting in the 77 kg weight class. So that process, because obviously it's a weight class sport for a reason. The bigger you are, there's advantages to being bigger in martial arts.
Yep.
So that's like a game within itself. And that last week is pretty much, you can add a bit of finishing touches technically. You're not going to be doing anything priming-wise from an S&C point of view or potentiation or anything like that, just because they're going to be on a low-calorie diet. They're going to be
grumpy. Flogged.
There's a massive like water cut involved in terms of like sweating it out, and so just get, and then after you've done that, made weight, you've got to get food back into you and electrolytes back into you, and that can be a really delicate process because now your stomach's in a kind of different state than what it's normally used to. So you eating what you feel like, or you eating, say, normally might be a bad idea for some. Some people might be fine with it, but some can be really sensitive, and you don't want any GI distress going into a fight either. So there's all these things around it where just considerations I hadn't fully comprehended until I was involved with it in detail.
Well, that makes sense. When you first said you got to be 10%, you know, to be 10% over, I was thinking, because a sport like rowing, and nationals was just cancelled, but we've got a number of rowers who row lightweight, and but they are weighing in under 2 hours before their race, so you just don't have that time to bounce back. It's like that's as close as you're going to be, and you want to be as close as possible. So it makes sense. If you're 10% over, then you can bounce back 15%. You've got maybe a 3 or 4 kg weight advantage over the other guy who, you know, doesn't bounce back as far. So are there anything, and understanding that there's a difference between nutrition for health and nutrition for performance, and there's even that, which is like a whole nother level. Any generalized lessons that you've learned that you can apply to other domains in, from a nutrition point of view?
Man, I'll tell you something we did with track and field. Track and field, we used to tell them to, or China too, if it was an English-speaking athlete, I'd refine this, but basically for the last 2 weeks, they'd eat around about half or three quarters of what they normally eat, because now they'd be lighter, right? You're going to fly more if you're lighter. And in those last 2 weeks, you're probably not going to lose any absolute power qualities. So your relative power will go up now just because you're lighter. You don't have as much bulk in your stomach. And so there's things I'd known from, say, bodybuilding and how they prepare and doing like a low fiber diet and all that sort of things, or cutting weight. Using low fiber, and I'll do that with track and field guys, but just with China, need to be really simple in terms of this sure. is, you're going to float more, run fast, and that was definite consideration.
And what were some of the, you know, what's your typical paradigm for that, those last 2 weeks? Are you thinking you know, low carb, low fats? Do you think low calories? What is your starting paradigm for that,
for track and field?
Yeah, for track and field, to lose weight in those last two weeks.
So this is how you lose weight. You lose weight by either reducing calories or reducing carbohydrates or reducing fiber, because there's bulk in the stomach that you can get rid of by having a low fiber diet that you'll weigh less.
Yep.
It's just a physical property. So it's, and then carbohydrates, the same thing.
Yep. Or well, from a glycogen storage perspective, yeah, and water.
Exactly. And associated water. So if you wanted to go down that route, you could definitely use that, but you just have to marry that up with any performance impairments that you might have with, say, sprinting or so those alactic events, which there might not be that many,
yep,
to be fair.
Yep.
Long jump, though, you can, if you have six jumps, you get into the final, that can take like that. That's actually, it's like repeated sprints, depending on the size of the field and so on. So,
yep,
there's those type of considerations. But yeah, you can definitely manipulate body mass to reduce or to improve chances of improving like relative power.
Yep.
Watts per kg.
Yep. We've got a question here from Sabrina. Why she's referring to your fighting, making weight there. Why is it such an aggressive cut in the last week? Have you found it affects performance? And what's the difference between doing a slower cut? Have you noticed the difference with athletes?
Yeah, so look, there's, I'll take this back a step. So I've got a saying, you don't want your fight camp to be a fit camp or a fat camp.
Yeah, so gotcha, means, yeah.
You don't want to be needing to waste time during your fight camp, maybe last 6 to 8 weeks, on trying to get fitter or trying to lose weight. So you want to make that process as like as smooth as possible in terms of your weight descent down to 10% over. The reason why it's 10% is because that's achievable for most people based on basic physiology in the last sort of 10 to 7 days. You drop and you want to lose the weight too while keeping some form of carbohydrate in there too, because if you take carbohydrate out immediately, then when you go to do your actual weight cut, now you don't have something to play with.
Yep.
And 10% is like, some people might lose 15% in that last week, being really aggressive, maybe even a bit older. That would be like a warning sign, but that people do it all the time. It's not unusual, although not recommended. So 10% is not actually a severe cut. It's a very moderate, safe cut based on physiology and based on dropping carbohydrate, dropping fiber, dropping salt, and then also sweating to get the weight loss off.
Now, just on that, so you don't want your fight camp to be fit camp or fat camp or whatever. One thing is, at least in the first, probably 10 or 12 years of my career, it was mainly football based. So it was a very luxurious position because I could increase strength and increase weight at the same time. It was actually a very lazy way of doing it. I just give you bench and you do it, whatever. And then moving into tennis, things changed quite significantly because, you want to be as light as possible, and as strong as possible. And then it went up a whole nother step working with mountain bikers, because mountain bikers, same thing. You want to add strength, but you don't want to add a single, that they're paying 22 grand for a bike to save a couple of grams. So you don't want to put that on in the gym. What are some of the paradigms you use currently with your UFC fighters? And I'm sure there would have been similar ones with your track and field, where you're looking at increasing strength, but making sure that body mass is either maintained or possibly even decreased.
Yeah, so there's a programming consideration. There's also a consideration that, and I'm going to tell you about the flip side of this as well, an example where we've actually had to put on mass because we want a person to be heavier for the weight class. And it's been really common in China with our academy fighters that they've been in a weight class that's too heavy for them. So we've moved them down and said, look, we actually want you to be heavier walking around day to day and get used to being heavier so that when you cut, you're in an appropriate weight class for your size. Yeah. With mixed martial arts, they're doing so much training, it's actually hard to put mass on them.
Mm-hmm.
All right. If they're doing nothing, like anybody though, and they eat a lot of food or whatever, they're going to put on size. But with the amount of training, you get, like, I'm a big believer in, if you want to change a person's body composition, you do it through diet first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also a big believer in things like hypertrophy protocols and stuff like that to put on mass. Works great for bodybuilders that don't have to play a sport and don't have technical training, say 4 hours a day. But if you've got that training, it's not going to do much. It's probably just going to be junk for you. So get your body composition manipulation from some other form diet. You know what I mean? And there is a consideration in the gym that we want to train for the sport. And say with these guys that I talked about, hey, you want to we want you to put on lean body mass, or we want to change your body composition so you get a bit more muscle, a bit less fat. A lot of these, you got to recognize where the person's come from. And one of my big philosophies is efficiency. Do as little as possible to get the desired result. Because just like, say, you're going into weight cutting, you've already cut out carbohydrates, it's not really efficient because you could have kept them in there the whole time, mm-hmm. and you've got one less thing to play with. So be as efficient as possible, because it always gives you more cards up your sleeve to have an interview with an athlete.
Yep.
So if these guys from China, maybe they've come in, they might have had maybe, let's just say, one good meal of meat per day, you know what I mean, protein size, a good solid protein size. The rest might be noodles or so on, not a great amount of protein. So now they're eating three big protein meals a day. Do you think they're going to put on some lean body mass? Probably right. So is it a good thing at the same time for us to be doing hypertrophy in the gym and so on? No, we just let them eat the three meals. We see what happens. Mm-hmm. Then when it runs out, then maybe we try giving them a protein shake. Then maybe we try doing a few hypertrophy reps, like in a sequential fashion. So
it sounds like you're very clear on this process, and you're just saying, okay, let's earn the right with strategy A, which is going to be the least disruption. And once you've maximized that or plateaued with that strategy, then we move to strategy B. And Joe, while you're saying that, like, I was thinking of some of the mistakes I've made as a young coach where, you know, giving bands and chains to a young athlete, and I was jumping straight to strategy G, but they, you know, we could have just got them stronger on push-ups or something. But is that kind of the protocol or mindset?
Yeah, 100%. Be efficient with what you're doing. Don't waste things. You know what I mean? If you can, here's an example. Just say you've got a kid in athletics. They're going 5K. They're doing a 5K. They want to do 5K under 20 minutes. If they can do a 5K under 20 minutes with only training two times a week, why would you do four times a week training with them?
Yeah. If that's a massive thing in my role with swimming, is how quickly some coaches feel they've got to, you know, accelerate someone. Oh, they just did well at States. They're under 14. Let's get them from four sessions to eight sessions. Like, no, mm-hmm. just use five. Start off with, you know, maximize that, plateau that.
For sure.
Now, team, we're approaching the 1 hour mark. I'm going to open it up. So if you've got any questions, please feel free to use the chat. Joe's making my mind spin with some of the things that I want to, some tangents and things I want to go on, but please feel free to use it. And we'll open up the chat option soon. Joseph, what would you tell? So let's go. I think we presented together in 2010 for that surfing tennis presentation. Going back in time, 10 years ago, what would you tell a young Joseph Coyne? A younger Joseph Coyne.
Man. What wouldn't I tell him? I tell you what. Jeez. So I'd probably say, and this is a hard one too. Like I part of it, I was like, basically I was playing footy. I was trying to make ends meet, all those sorts of things. But I'd say definitely volunteer your time and get practical experience. Volunteer your time as early as possible. Mm-hmm. My circumstances may have meant that I couldn't do it, but how you basically get it, if you're interested in being involved in elite sport, you either get into it through interning, you know what I mean, or you get into it through doing a research degree. In yep. most cases, mm-hmm. you know what I mean, you do some research through a university with a particular sport, and then when you finish, they go, oh yeah, we need a sports science person or a strength conditioning person. Can you do that job? Or the interning route. Like I think the prime example of this is like Paddy Lane at Sydney Roosters. Is a guy come and did an internship. 2.5 years later, he's running the he's got one of the premier jobs in S&C in Australia. So that's the route. So definitely volunteer your time. I'd also say focus only on a few key things rather than getting dragged and pulled in different directions. And just eliminate the other things. Just have your 2 to 3 key things that you want to achieve. So, man, I used to, I don't know if you've heard of it, like a gratitude journal.
Yeah.
Where you, you write down what you want to, what you're grateful for on one page. Then on the other page, you write down what you want to be grateful for in the future, but put it in past tense.
Okay. I didn't know about step B, but I knew about step A. Okay. That's interesting. Yep.
Yeah. So step B, just like maybe it's the secret stuff, whatever. You know what I mean? But it just sets up, whether it's subconscious, who knows? So me being me, I was pretty skeptical, but man, I did it. And I did it for maybe like 2.5 years. This was like 2009. Wrote down things like, hey, I want to be recognized as a world leader in S&C. I want to present around the world. I want to do standing back salt, snatch my body weight, own a beach run home. All the stuff came true, Grant. Like, okay. And I was like, one of my biggest things I would say, and then I stopped doing it. I stopped doing it for about 10 years. And not in that time, but this is just like a personal reflection, I'd say, I kind of feel I got dragged around on a few things too much instead of applying like laser-like focus. And this was my, it was just a tool for me. Maybe it's not for everyone else, but it was like my mechanism to keep reminding myself about what's important and what to really focus on in terms of not going off on that tangent or not going off on that tangent, just staying laser-like and what I want to get out of life. So those would be the things I'd tell myself.
So tell me part B of that. So part A was gratitude for what's happened. And part D, you write down what you want to do, but you write it down in the past tense.
Yeah, exactly. So say right now I'm doing my PhD, right? And I'd write down in part B on the second page, I'm grateful for finishing my PhD and getting 8 papers published at my PhD. And then I'd write down something else, like there'll be something like professional, something personal. I'm grateful for being, say I want to be a jiu-jitsu black belt. I'm grateful for being a jiu-jitsu black belt. I'm not anywhere close yet, but that sets it in your mind and keeps reminding you of what you actually want to do with your life on a daily basis.
That's awesome. I think Scott Adams, the writer of, or the cartoonist, talks, it's not called mantras, it's daily sayings. I can't remember the term. Affirmations, that's it. And he talks about the same sort of thing. It's a great book if you ever read his book, something about failing and still succeeding or something like that. And he talks about that. And it's I think it's the same thing, just repackaged about that. Now, Joe, I wanted to go, but I've just checked my notes and there's another question that I do have for you. You physically fit. I remember you were going to the US and doing those 24-hour races. What are they called? Tough Mudder, I think it was, or whatever. You've snatched body weight? You've snatched 100, have you, or somewhere around there?
Yep.
That, to me, that's always been a big part of you. You've maintained physical condition. You're a father of 2. You're married. You've had a business. You're now living in China. You've done your career has not detracted from that physical component. How much has that affected your coaching?
Like negatively or positively? I'd say both. So in China, here's the thing. Like 2 things that worked really well for me in China. First of all, I'd go out and go for dinners with coaches and would get, basically when you go for a dinner with a Asian coach or a Chinese coach, you're going to get mad drunk and you donate a liver for the cause and then you're like best buddies from then on.
Yep.
So that was one of the things that worked really well for me. I fitted into that culture, maybe it was being a New Zealander and the drinking culture in New Zealand or something like that, but there was something I felt that. The other thing is that I could look the part in certain exercises and perform a lot of the things. And when, if you don't have language to use as a expression or it's handicapped in some way, shape or form, then being able to look the part definitely makes a difference. And I'm the same, man. Like if you, and this is just me thinking, but if you say you're an S&C coach and you're not in shape, I'm going to be like, well, how much do you really know? Unless you're 50, you know what I mean? Unless you're like you're 45, 50 plus and you know, and it's just natural. But if you're a young guy or a young lady and you're like, yeah, I'm an S&C coach and you don't look the part, then I'm going to be like, well, are you really? Because you can't help anyone else until you know how to help yourself.
Yep.
And so if you can't help yourself and get changes in yourself, how are you going to get changes in me? And this is what I would be thinking of as an athlete. And it's just it's not true in 100% of cases. I know that there's people that can, they might not look the part, but they've got wonderful knowledge and they work super well with athletes. But that's just my first impression of what I'd be thinking.
Yeah, 100%. I worry about that. I think it's something, and there's sort of two aspects to it, isn't it? There's the physical appearance, but it's also your own training. You can be your first experiment. You can be your first, bit of experience that you gain about, okay, wait a second. I remember when I first started squatting and I realized how tight my hips were. And I was like, oh, wow, I've got to address that before. And then that gives you some kind of understanding before you maybe train your friends or low-level athletes, and you can build from there. And I feel if you miss that first step, it just delays you, I guess, is what I'm saying. It delays your experience and that.
100%. You're your own experiment.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether I'm 100% down like being a Renaissance man but I like to think that you should develop your mind as equally as you should develop your body, as well as your spirit. So, and these things like what you mentioned about squatting, like if I could say to a young coach, hey, you should do gymnastics, adult gymnastics for a year. It'll teach you about leverage. It'll teach you about body control. It'll teach you about being explosive and getting using momentum to actually express power. You should compete in weightlifting.
Mm-hmm.
Right, go to a weightlifting club and train in weightlifting for a year. You should go and do track and field. If you haven't done it as an athlete, go and do it and go on some races, all those sorts of things. You should probably do a martial art for a year.
Mm-hmm.
There's heaps of things that you learn. Like I do the ASA podcast, and this has just popped up in my head right now, but you've been on it, Grant. Great episode, by the way. Ross Smith was on it, and he was talking about like people getting lower back problems. Ross Smith's from the AIS. Getting lower back problems because they don't have good coordination between lower body and upper body, so that link isn't there. And so one of the things he tries to do is improve that. But there's so many exercises, say jiu-jitsu line drills or exercise in martial arts that teach this coordination between upper body, lower body. You should probably go out and run a marathon.
Yep.
Do a couple of marathons, see what it's like to train for that. Try multiple diets.
Yep. That's a big one. That's such a big one to me is... I don't understand how you're in physical performance and at least experiment, at least trial it, at least you might not agree with low carb or low fat, or you might not, but you've seen how it feels like. I always tell the story. In 2005, I started experimenting with low carb, and Joseph, I was a prick for 2 hours every day at about 3 o'clock to about 5, just because I was struggling and I had this, fuzziness and all this kind of stuff. And I was, and it lasted for 2 weeks. So when people talk about the carb flu, or I don't know what they call it, something, I can say, yeah, cool. Like and then when a research paper comes out and says, you know, we tried low carb for 2 weeks, I can reflect on my own experience and think in 2 weeks, I wasn't even thinking performance. I was just trying to get back to feel normal. Like, I was irritable and grumpy and all that kind of stuff. But it's because I tried it. Like it was, again, I was my first experiment before I even tried anyone else. And I've tweaked things since then, but I gave it a crack.
Yeah, 100%, man. Yeah. And it's nutrition is such a massive role. Like, and what we do and saying you want to be an S&C coach, you need to have an understanding of diet and nutrition and like you said, you're your own best experiment. And before you can, although you might not be given the advice in some settings, guaranteed, even if there's a dietitian with a team and you're involved in a professional setting, or you're at a school or anything like that, guaranteed you'll have somebody come up to you and ask you about diet or nutrition.
Exactly.
There'll be some impact. There might be scope of practice things involved, but look, or you can say, hey, my experience, this worked well for me.
Exactly. All right, team. Joseph, thank you very much. We're going to see, does anyone want to turn their mics off mute? Joseph, you've got a question here. And John, you want to go first? Ask your question to Joe.
Thanks, Grant. Joseph, you mentioned earlier about the concept of the barbell compressing the spine, possibly leading to a change in motor equipment and coordination. Can that be applied to other sports that require coordination, such as hitting or pitching in baseball, bowling and cricket? I feel like all sports require coordinations, but for those ones specifically, or maybe not those specifically, just across the board?
Yeah, mate. So, and this is just my conjecture as well. There's nothing hard and fast. There are studies showing this compression is like 40% less if you wear a belt when you have axial load on. So I would be thinking about it in the lead up to events for something that required really high velocity movements. And an older athlete, maybe an athlete that had previous back problems, all those sorts of things that they would weigh into it for sure. And there's so many exercises out there that you'll be able to find something that will give you something that you would have got with a bar on the back without a bar on your back if you wanted to do it that way.
Thank you.
Joseph White, you've got a question. Do you want to ask Joseph Coyne? Joe, are you there? Oh, okay. Joe White typed in a question. Oh, he's just said that they've got builders there, so he's not going to turn his mic on. From Joseph White. So Joe Coyne, this is a squash player of mine that we used to train for a few years together. Has your approach or paradigm to training for explosive force in UFC changed compared to athletics?
It hasn't changed. The paradigm hasn't changed, but just how you get there is different. It's definitely different. And say track and field, they're not doing regularly high heart rates, generating a lot of lactate from technical training, right? They're working hard, and there's stuff, but there's just a different way of getting there. And so anything you get, it's not as specialized, but the actual paradigm of how you want to improve power or improve high velocity movements hasn't changed. It's just you've got to account for a few more factors and realize that there's going to be a few more things that might be holding that person back from getting the optimal results. And there's cultural things as well. Like, for instance, you do aerobic work with a MMA guy and you want to keep them below a certain heart rate, they're going to be like, nah, it's too easy. I need to go faster. And then you try and do real like high speed power exercises. They might say, it's too light, or the rest period's too long. So it's understanding those cultural factors as well and working into it. So the paradigm hasn't changed, but how you might go about getting the same results. Like, you still got to do the high power, high speed activities, and you still have to modify the force velocity curve at the point where you want it. For instance, if you're sprinting is down here in the, say, bottom right, and lifting maximal weight is up top in the top left of a force velocity curve. Like, my grandmother will tell you that if you do a lot of heavy weights, it's pretty far away from the sprinting aspect of that force velocity curve. So maybe you want to try something a bit closer to that sprinting part of the force velocity curve if you actually want to change that part of it. So there's that style thinking as well.
Okay. Joseph, thoroughly enjoyed this chat. I've learned a truckload and I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming on. To the rest of the team, don't forget, we've got Ben Cross, who's at the Broncos as a coach, and he's applying what he learned from Craig Bellamy and as a player and applying that. Coming up, we've got Andrew Russell, who spent 14 years at the Hawthorn Hawks and is now at Carlton doing the rebuild over there as a high performance manager. Jove, before we cancel here, how can everyone get hold of you?
Man.
Joseph Coyne on Twitter.
Yeah, Joseph Coyne on Twitter.
Yep. So at Joseph Coyne, Coyne. If you want to, is your Instagram's the same, isn't it? At Joseph Coyne.
Yeah, Instagram's the same. There must not be that many Joseph Coynes out there, but I've got same thing. Instagram, Twitter, Joseph Coyne.
Twitter. If you want to see Joseph with his shirt off, jump on that. And if you've got a question for Joseph, feel free to email us on the contact page on propelperform.com and I'll forward that through and then we can leave it up to there. But guys, thank you very much for this chat. Joe, really appreciate your time and stay warm in Canada.
Mate, thank you. No, it's been a pleasure, Grant. As always, love chatting with him, my friend.
All right.
We'll keep in contact more. I miss you, mate.
Cool beans. Miss you too, Joe. I'll catch you later.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.